Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the revelation in the New York Times of 49 questions Robert Mueller wants to ask President Trump, which has Trump tweeting indignantly that the leak is so disgraceful, even though there is a very real possibility the leak of these questions came from the White House, since they did not come from the special counsel's office. Stephen Harper, a lawyer and professor at Northwestern University who has compiled a comprehensive timeline of the Trump-Russia story at billmoyers.com and at investigaterussia.org, joins us to discuss whether the leak is part of a determined strategy on the part of the White House and the Republicans to shut down the Mueller probe. With Rudolph Giuliani now supposedly negotiating with Robert Mueller to bring the inquiry to a swift end, the suspicion arises that this may be a setup to close it down by claiming Mueller is uncooperative and is dragging out what Trump calls a witch hunt. If indeed the White House leaked these questions, while it may feed the deep state hysteria in the Fox News bubble, it may also backfire with the broader public, who can easily see from the questions which Trump is being asked to answer that Mueller knows a lot more and he is looking at real collusion between Trump's family and his top officials and the Russians. Then on this May Day, we will discuss the growing number of teachers' strikes in red states in which teachers are not just demanding living wages, since from 1996 to 2015, teachers' pay actually fell by $30 per week on a national average, but they are striking on behalf of their students for more investments in schools, pupils, and school supplies. Sylvia Allegretto, the co-chair of the Center for Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley, who has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, joins us to discuss the teacher pay gaps and why teachers are fighting back. Then finally, we'll examine further the erosion of America's middle class, with 63% of Americans one paycheck away from the street and unable to deal with a $500 emergency, while over one-third are running out of food, not being able to afford a place to live or have money to pay for medical treatment. Sarah Jaffe, a Nation Institute fellow and an independent journalist covering labor and economic justice and author of Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt, joins us to discuss how working and middle-class Americans should take a cue from the teachers and mobilize to demand better pay and a fairer country. And joining us now is Stephen Harper, a professor of Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He's the author of several books, including Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster's Story, and he blogs at The Belly of the Beast, and he has a comprehensive timeline of the Trump-Russia story up at billmoyers.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Harper.
Thank you, Ian. Let me add one other thing, too. We just recently, and we're in the process, actually, of moving the timeline to the Committee to Investigate Russia, which you may have noticed, it's Rob Reiner's new site that's collecting a lot of this sort of stuff. With Bill's retirement at the end of the year, we've been looking for a good home for the timeline, and we think we have found it. So,
what's the address for this site?
InvestigateRussia.org.
InvestigateRussia.org. So I think a big contribution was made by the New York Times. It's in today's print edition, where they have 49 questions that appear to come from Robert Mueller to Trump's lawyers. And I think this is a big movement forward, is it not, in terms of the public's understanding of what's going on?
You know, it's an interesting development. Here's the way I look at it. My first reaction is that I think that the New York Times buried the lead, because the important thing to remember about this is that none of these leaks are coming from Mueller's team. So you have to ask yourself, why is somebody on Trump's team leaking this, and why are they doing it now? And when you get to the fifth paragraph of the New York Times article, they finally do acknowledge that their source is someone who provided a document to them that was a list of questions that someone on Trump's legal team wrote down as someone on Mueller's team was reviewing with them the list of questions. So then you ask yourself, okay, what's behind this? And we can talk about that if you want. I think it's important to talk about it, because I think what's behind it is that And I'm not sure it'll work at all, because I think it may actually have the effect that you're describing of educating the public. But I think what's behind it is at least an effort, and you can see it already on some of the right-wing blogs, to portray this as illustrative of a special counsel, Robert Mueller, being sort of beyond his mandate or out of control or any number of other ways that I think you're going to see a continued, it's been ongoing anyway, but a continued effort to undermine the Mueller investigation. But I do think it's useful because it does give you a sense, and it gives the public a sense, of how wide-ranging and, frankly, but at the same time focused, Special Counsel Mueller's team is. And to me, you know, and Mueller's a terrific lawyer, and he has some of the very best lawyers in the country working with him on this stuff. And the other thing to keep in mind, too, is that, like all good lawyers, there's a very high probability that they know the answers to these questions, regardless of what Trump has to say in response. But I think it's an interesting exercise. For those of us who've been following the Trump-Russia timeline for a year and a half in a very detailed way, there's very little that's new. But I think the thread gets lost, and I think this does help to restore the thread.
Well, I think what Trump tweeted out today supports what you were just saying, Stephen, in that Trump says, so disgraceful that the questions concerning the Russia witch hunt were leaked to the media. No question on collusion. Oh, I see. You have made up a phony crime, collusion, that never existed, and an investigation began with illegally leaked classified information. Nice. Apart from the self-pity, it seems to be in line with what you're saying, that this was the motive. But there's also another possible explanation of why this was leaked from, I guess, from Dowd's people. Dowd was the lawyer who quit because he was frustrated with Trump, who wanted to have a face-to-face meeting with Mueller and answer questions. And Dowd thought that Trump would expose himself because he's a catastrophe in terms of thinking he can handle Mueller. So it's equally possible that somebody on the inside, why do you think we're getting all these leaks from the inside of Trump White House? Because people on the inside are disgusted by this person who's the president of the United States. They think the American people should know what they see on a daily basis, that this uncontrolled, incompetent, insane presidency.
Could be, but I think it's equally plausible that this is just part of, as I was describing, an ongoing and orchestrated effort that really has as its target the Mueller investigation, whether it's by firing Rosenstein or the talk about firing Sessions for a while, and I don't know who they said it was the source in the according to the Times was somebody not on Trump's legal team, and I don't know, you know, it's hard to know for sure, but I would not discount the possibility that this is just really something, and you saw it even last night, you know, within a couple of hours. Hugh Hewitt was essentially saying that this proves you got an investigation. You know, he's become a very vocal supporter of Trump. Was saying on Twitter, this is proof that the Mueller investigation needs to be shut down. Once there was a determination of or investigation that failed to reveal facts relating to collusion, that should have been the end of it. Well, of course, the irony of that position is that of the questions that are posed, the second largest group of questions are questions relating directly to the topic of collusion. So it's far from a closed issue, notwithstanding Trump's tweeted lie to the contrary.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Harper, who's a professor at Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He is the author of several books, including Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster's Story, and he blogs at The Belly of the Beast and has a comprehensive timeline of the Trump-Russia story up at BillMoyes.com, and it's now at, what was again, the Rob Reiner site?
Yes, the Committee to Investigate Russia, which is investigaterussia.org.
So let's add to what you're saying, because I think you're onto something, Stephen. My sense is that the reason that they brought Giuliani aboard, because Giuliani knows Mueller from working together in the New York prosecutor's office, isn't it likely that what's really going on there, that Giuliani's going to say, I tried to get Mueller to wrap this thing up. We did everything we could. We bent over backwards, but they're resistant. They want to drag this out. This is obviously a witch hunt, and I can only recommend that the president fire Mueller. Do you think it's a setup, in other words?
Yeah, I don't know if he'd go so far as to give that horrible advice, although he might, to fire Mueller. But I think the rest of it is, and in terms of a general sort of laying mattresses, if you will, you know, for the public, so that when some axe falls, whatever that axe may look like, that impairs the Mueller investigation. You know, the easier thing for Trump to do, rather than fire Mueller outright, and this has been my concern for a very long time, would be to simply one of two things: either replace Sessions, in which case his replacement could then take over from Rosenstein, or you fire Rosenstein. And ultimately, either of those events would put someone different in charge of the Mueller investigation and be in a position to really clip Mueller's wings in a way that would prevent future indictments and limit the scope and ultimately, you know, lead the investigation of the resources that it needed to be completed. So my own view is it's all just part of a much larger program. And you could even couple it with, and I think you should couple it with, the obstructionist efforts, if you will, that have been happening with a complicit Republican group in Congress who just recently, you know, they leaked that they had draft impeachment articles for Rod Rosenstein. So, you know, this is all of a piece. It's all the same. It's all part of the same program, I think.
It's hard to believe that these right-wing Republicans, these Tea Party Republicans, don't see the shameful reality that they're co-conspirators in potential treason. And it's amazing to see how the political landscape has shifted. Traditionally, right-wing Republicans were always red baiters and Soviet haters, and now they're all making excuses for Putin. And on the left, people that were normally suspicious of the so-called deep state are now hoping that the deep state comes up with the evidence to put Trump in a orange jumpsuit and march him out of the Oval Office.
But yeah, it's an ironic turn of events, to say the least. And of course, what always gets lost in the shuffle of Trump's brain when he talks about witch hunts and the Democrats out to get him, is that when you run down the roster, you know, some of the people who are persisting in the investigation have been lifelong Republicans. You know, James Comey, Robert Mueller, Rod Rosenstein, Jeff Sessions. I mean, you know, and as you rightly note, the FBI, at least historically and traditionally, has been regarded as a very conservative organization. Obviously, it has a mix of political views, but if you had to guess, you know, if you had to just sort of throw a dart against a wall that included the entire roster of the FBI, you probably had a much better chance of hitting a Republican than a Democrat. So it's ironic, and I think that at the end of the day, you know, the people who call themselves the Freedom Caucus in Congress, along with people like, I guess Devin Nunes is in that group for sure. I don't know if he's in the Freedom Caucus, but he's certainly, history will not be kind to those people. It really will not. But they seem not to care. They just seem not to care.
Well, you know, unfortunately, my understanding is that the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, are not running the best candidate against Nunes. He'd be very beatable. It's almost 50% Latino, that district in the Central Valley of California. And instead of running a local Latino activist community organizer in the spirit of Barack Obama, they're running somebody else. So this may have a lot more to do with the Democrats shooting themselves in the foot than the fact that Nunes is arrogant, which he clearly is.
And yeah, you know, the interesting thing about Nunes too, I was talking Friday evening. I was on Lawrence O'Donnell's show talking about the committee report. You know, which of course that's Nunes' committee concluding that there was no quote unquote no collusion, no evidence of collusion. And I think, you know, everyone has lost track of the fact that, you know, Nunes was on the Trump transition team after the election. And Nunes, by his own admission to a Newsweek reporter in December, late December of 2016, said that he was in daily and sometimes more frequently than once a day contact with Mike Flynn. And we all know now what Mike Flynn was doing at the end of December. So, you know, I think that the people, you know, you take a step back and look at the longer scope of Nuna's involvement in this thing. And it's, and then of course we don't even need to, you need to remind people of all the antics of the midnight run with the so-called documents that were going to prove Trump right about Obama wiretapping and all that nonsense. And you know, you gotta, if you're looking at Nuna's, you know, you look at a little bit of context, and it's an ugly picture.
Well, but the guy that Nunez met on the midnight run to the White House was a guy called Ezra Cohen Watnick, who was on Flynn's National Security Council, brought aboard by Flynn. He was given the important role of head of intelligence. Trump recently personally forced the appointment of Ezra Cohen Watnick, who was fired, of course, from the National Security Council, when the new National Security Advisor came aboard after Flynn, who's now subsequently quit or been fired, and now we have Bolton. But Ezra Cohen Watnick, his appointment was forced on the DOJ by Trump himself, and now he is in the National Security Division of the Department of Justice. And I can guarantee you, Stephen, that his job there is to scuttle the Mueller investigation. And I think they've already shown the model of how they do it, this administration, with Mick Mulvaney. They moved him, well, he's moonlighting as the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. His position there is not legally sound, yet he's destroying the Bureau. So there you have it.
Yeah, there was. I'm not sure about whether. You know, I think there's a question about whether Cohen Watnick himself was actually the one. I think it was somebody. I think it was a different individual. Michael Ellis, I think, is the name, who actually supposedly provided the documents to White House documents to Mueller. But it's clear that Ezra Cohen Watnick was involved, at least in assembling documents, and was involved in a project that related to all that. And you're right. I mean, one of the fears I've had, think about the fact that Scott Pruitt is still somehow survived all this, and then ask yourself if what isn't going on here, at least potentially, is holding him in reserve for the inevitable sort of squeezing out of Jeff Sessions, however that occurs, and then an interim appointment that puts Scott Pruitt in, who, of course, will do Trump's bidding to no end, and probably with delight when it came to clipping Special Counsel Mueller's wings on the investigation.
Well, there's a piece in the New York Times today by Michelle Goldberg who describes this situation as truth versus power. And she posits that power is winning. In other words, Trump's winning in terms of shutting this thing down. But, of course, I think that she wrote that column before the New York Times broke this story. So in that framework of truth versus power, what do you think, Stephen, is the important stuff in these 49 questions that the special counsel had drafted to ask Trump? And I believe this was done in March, only, a month ago,
a little over a month ago,
and it was done, it was about the time that Trump's lawyer, John Dowd, quit.
Right. Well, as I mentioned, I do think there's a very high probability that with respect to all of these questions, Mueller already has either documentary or cooperating witnesses or other witnesses who have given him the answers. And he's up against, if he is up against Trump, he's up against a guy who he knows cannot keep his story straight. I would pull two things out. One on the Russia connections. I would say the central theme there is what did Trump know and when did he know it? And you've got everything from the Trump Tower meeting to the business dealings with Trump Tower in Moscow, to the platform changes, sanctions policy, communications with Flynn, the Ukrainian peace plan, and then even continuing with back-channel efforts after the election that Flynn, we know, was involved in. So that'd be one category. I would call it sort of the Russian connections. I'm always reluctant to call it collusion because I think that's such a misnomer. The right concept is conspiracy. And the specific legal claim would be conspiracy against the United States. On the second theme I would pull away would be on obstruction. And there it's sort of an echoing back to the old, Howard Baker question of witnesses in Watergate. What did the president know and when did he know it? In this case, what did candidate Trump or President-elect Trump know and when did he know it? And if you go through that, if you think about it with those sort of themes in mind, you can really account for just about every single question that's asked. You know, why did you do what you did with Flynn? What did you know about what was happening, and why did you do and say what you did with Comey and Sessions? And what about these tweets? I thought that was sort of interesting that they're actually asking about very specific tweets, which to many lawyers, including me, at the time looked like witness intimidation and or tampering, which is a different form of obstruction. So that's the way I would look at it. And then if you take that and look at within those two broad categories, you wind up with, you know, those two broad themes, you wind up with four categories. You get questions relating to Flynn, which there are five. You get questions relating to Comey, of which there are 18. You get questions relating to Sessions, of which there are 8. And then you get questions relating to Russia collusion, conspiracy, whatever you want to call it, communications, of which there are, as I say, the second largest group of questions, 13. So anyone who tells you that, including Trump, that the book on collusion, the Mueller book on collusion, is closed, is they're wrong. It's these questions prove that they are absolutely incorrect about that.
Well, it's obviously open because clearly about Manafort and his connections, we know that his right hand guy, his deputy in Ukraine, was a GRU colonel in active communication with the Russian military intelligence. There are questions about him in terms of collusion. I mean, it's extraordinary that, you know, both Michael Cohen, who was also, they talk about the so-called peace plan, that was another thing cooked up by a pro-Russian Ukrainian lawmaker. Both Manafort and Cohen, of course, are married to Ukrainian women, and they have very deep ties to Yanukovych, Putin's puppet, who was driven out of the country by people power.
Correct. And you know, I've thought since the moment that he pled out that Rick Gates was going to be far more important as a witness who provided continuity. Because, you know, the thing to remember about Rick Gates is that even after Manafort left the campaign, Rick Gates stayed on. And he stayed on through the transition. And then after the election, he went to work for one of the largest political action, pro-Trump political action organizations in Washington. And Rick Gates is somebody who may be very surprising to people in the narrative that he's able to provide, that links a lot of different things that go far beyond just his business dealings with Manafort. And I think you know, it's a reflection of Flynn's significance that, I don't know if people remember, probably there's no reason why anyone but me should, or people that have been following the story extraordinarily closely, probably unhealthily closely. But, you know, there was a report back in, I think it was in the summer, well, for sure it was in the summer of 2017, where Trump reportedly called Mike Flynn, or had somebody call, communicate from Trump to Mike Flynn that he should, quote-unquote, stay strong. And that sort of echoed back in my mind when I heard that back on Friday the 13th, while Michael Cohen's lawyers were in court arguing about privileged documents, Trump called to, quote-unquote, check in with Michael Cohen. You know, these are not, you know, the outlines of what the narrative looks like for someone who has a consciousness of guilt, as lawyers would say, seems pretty clear, and we don't need to go through all the data points. There's lots of them. You know, the more interesting question is, what is the narrative that fits all these things together that's a narrative of innocence? You know, more than 50 communications between the Trump people and Russians during the campaign and the transition involving a dozen people all the way to the very top of the Trump food chain. What's the narrative of innocence that, you know, and that's just a small slice of it. You know, you can go down and include all the different collapsing defenses. You know, first there were no contacts. Well, it turns out there were more than 50. Then there was no collusion. Well, it turns out Trump Jr. says, oh, if you have dirt, I love it. Well, then it turns out, no, it's just opposition research. Everyone would do it. Well, except, yeah, that's illegal when it's coming from a foreign government. And then it's like, well, they didn't really give us anything. And then it's like, well, it didn't help. And then it's like, and then finally we get to, well, it doesn't matter, he's still won in the Electoral College. So these collapsing defenses, which is another thing that lawyers look at when you look at you know, why things are happening as they're happening, when people are abandoning defenses and trying to come up with new ones.
Sure.
It's also telling.
Well, Stephen Harper, I thank you for joining us, and I appreciate your timeline, and certainly a lot of it's been augmented by the revelations in the New York Times.
Absolutely, yep. Well, thank you very much. I'm always happy to be talking to you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Harper. He's a professor at Northwestern University and a regular contributor to The American Lawyer. He's the author of several books, including Crossing Hoffa, A Teamster Story. He blogs at The Belly of the Beast, and he has a comprehensive timeline of the Trump-Russia story up at BillMoyers.com, and it's also up at InvestigateRussia.org. We're going to take a brief station break, and on this May Day, we'll come back and discuss the growing number of teacher strikes in red states.
Want me to do? Yes, you have, girl. Don't you know you gotta tell the truth, yeah? Baby, why don't you tell me the truth now? You know you got me doing everything crazy that you want me to do. Yes, you have, yeah. Watch it.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us on this May Day is Silvia Allegretto, a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, teacher pay, public employee compensation, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. Welcome to Background Briefing, Silvia Allegretto.
Yes, Ian, great to be here.
And teachers are on strike in red states. They're on strike now. They've been demonstrating for several days now in Arizona, also in Colorado, and before that in West Virginia, Oklahoma, and Kentucky. And you have done a study. We're told that the lowest paid teachers in the country are in Arizona and Colorado, but you've done a study that's far more accurate and far more relevant. So tell us about the methodology where you pointed out in Arizona's teachers earn just 63% on the dollar compared with other college graduates, and the gap is 79 cents in Kentucky, 67 cents in Oklahoma, and 75 cents in West Virginia. Why is that a better metric?
Well, because the figures that you're stating from my study are actually done comparing teachers within states, so with other workers within each state, because we know there's a big difference in pay just based on cost of living. So, for instance, the cost of living in California is much higher than Mississippi, so all else being equal, you would expect teachers in California to be paid more. What matters is kind of what's happening within the state. So those numbers are taking into account, you know, how are teachers faring compared to other similarly educated workers within their states. And as you correctly identified, my work shows that the states where we've had a lot of the walkouts, Arizona, Colorado, Oklahoma, West Virginia, have some of the largest teacher pay gaps in the country.
But overall, your study points out that teachers' pay, accounting for inflation, actually fell by $30 per week from 1996 to 2015. That's a national statistic, right?
Right. So, you know, what we did and what we've been doing for over a decade now, and this is with my partner Larry Michel from the Economic Policy Institute, We went back all the way to 1960 in the first book that we put out over a decade ago. We showed that in 1960, teachers, who, by the way, were mostly women, which is the same today, did fairly well. They actually did about 15% better than comparable workers. Because don't forget, in 1960, women didn't have a lot of choice. Many occupations weren't open to women. So the good news is that women who were in teaching did pretty well. The bad news is they were kind of a captive labor pool. So what we show is there's like a, you know, we went from a 15% positive for teachers to now it's about a 17% negative. So the teacher penalty went from a positive to from a premium over the last several decades to a penalty. And that penalty for men, which probably explains why the share of teachers who are male hasn't changed very much in decade, is that teaching penalty for men is about 25%. So what we've showed is a long-term trend that is getting worse.
Well, interestingly enough, I don't know whether you watched the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which became controversial, Sylvia, because of the comedian Michelle Wolf. I thought one of the most telling lines that she had in her comedy, which was quite biting and I think extremely relevant, she said, I support Donald Trump's call to arm teachers in this country because that way teachers can sell their guns for school supplies.
That's right.
And I thought, that really gets to the heart of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, I've heard that. Look, the truth is that we can't adequately invest in our students without adequate investment in buildings, books, supplies, staff, and that includes teachers. And that's what, these teachers in most of these walkouts are asking for. They're not out there on the front lines just fighting for themselves. They're fighting for overall funding, and in a lot of cases, to replace funding that is far behind what it even was 10 years ago, especially in places like Oklahoma, Kentucky, Arizona, West Virginia. State funding is well below what it was even a decade ago, because they know without adequate investments in them, but also, again, the buildings, the books, the supply, there's just no way we can have a good public school sector. So I think it's really telling that they're trying to bring everybody up with them, and in the face of what has been enormous cuts, especially cuts that were ratcheted up post Great Recession. At the same time, we know, which we've talked a lot about, a lot of these states have given huge tax cuts to corporations and to millionaires and billionaires as their schools start to crumble.
And again, I'm speaking with Sylvia Allegretta, who's a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, teacher pay, public employee compensation, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. And it does seem that, at least to my mind, there's a connection here between the Republican takeover of the state legislatures back in 2010, at the time of the census, and so much of what's happened since has been the agenda of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is set up by the Koch brothers. And basically, they've gotten all of these Republican legislatures in these red states to go along with the Koch brothers' libertarian agenda. And of course, the Koch brothers, I don't imagine, for the life of me, I don't understand that kind of slash and burn mentality. I know they obviously went to private schools and don't have any connection to public schools, and that is the case with the current Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education. They don't have a connection to public schools, and they're busily trying to take money away from public schools to give them to charter schools, which on the surface, there's no logic to that, because if your public schools are in trouble, the last thing you do is take money away from them. But that's what they're doing. So do you see this in the light of people? And maybe you can answer this question that kind of bothers me, and I can't for the life of me figure it out, why these plutocrats are doing what they're doing. Do they want Americans to be stupid? I mean, you'd think you'd want an educated workforce if you're a plutocrat.
Well, that's right. But I think it really goes, you know, just to the broader notion that we're demonizing public sector workers, as you pointed out. A lot of this started out with the typical what happened in Wisconsin with Scott Walker, where, you know, the economy was blowing up due to the wizards on Wall Street, due to deregulation. It was blowing up all over the world. And he attacked who? Not Wall Street, not that institution. He attacked public sector workers. And I think it was working for a while. The public, the general public, was like, "Oh, I don't have benefits anymore. My pay isn't going anywhere. You know, why are these teachers doing so well?" Well, of course, my work has shown teachers have been falling further and further behind, but so has the average worker. So what was happening is this narrative of pitting private sector worker against public sector worker, but I think it's not happening anymore. People are seeing that anywhere there is a pot of public sector money, there is a constituency in this country who you've just mentioned that want to make sure that it goes through private sector hands as a form of profit, one way or another. That's why we have this push for charter schools. So the defunding of the public schools is exactly what it's supposed to do. It will make them worse, and then that strengthens their argument that they need more private sector and school choice, which is exactly what I wouldn't agree with. We need to just fix the public school systems, which are, you know, they're not perfect and they never have been, but to do what we're doing is just going to dismantle public education as we know it. And so what I think has happened, though, is that the general public is kind of seeing, and we've seen this with that they're pretty much on board and backing these teachers in these red states, in these right-to-work states, because they've seen over the last decade and even longer the books that their kids are bringing home that are woefully out of date. They're seeing schools that are crumbling. They're being asked to pay more for their kids to be able to participate in sports or to be in the band, having to pay more money for an instrument or to be in art class. And I think that finally they're seeing this kind of narrative that they have been pushing, that the problem is public sector workers, that it hasn't been right. And it's never going to do private sector workers who are unionized at, you know, about 6% now. It's never going to do private sector workers to turn on their public sector counterparts to make their lot in life better. What happens is what we really need is to get workers in general on board and fight for these worker rights, to fight for these walkouts. It should be a birthright in this country for workers who want to unionize, to form unions, and to have strong unions instead of the weak unions they have in the South. Don't forget, in these right-to-work states, these teachers were not even allowed to walk out. They were not allowed to strike. They did it anyway. They were wildcat strikes in some instances. And so I think in one respect we're like, wow, why is this happening in the South? In another respect, as my work shows, it's like it's gotten that bad that they were left, you know, without anything else to do except to act illegally, to walk out, and to bring attention to their plight.
Well, it's interesting that the richest American, I believe, is Jeff Bezos. He's worth about $131 billion, according to Forbes, and he did an interview the other day with the Spiegel in Germany, where he said that he was going to deploy much of his financial wealth from his holdings in Amazon into space travel and going to Mars. So it's an extraordinary thing that the richest man in the world can't even imagine paying his workers more or paying his fair share of taxes, but rather sending up these rockets into space as monuments of his wealth. And the same thing is happening, of course, with Elon Musk. So what explains that? I mean, we're thinking of these guys as the good billionaires as opposed to the reactionary people like the Koch brothers that are still making their wealth out of extraction industries. And, of course, the entire Trump administration has been turned over to the Koch brothers and others in the extraction industries in coal, like Blankenship, who's running for the Senate in West Virginia, and others. I was just, interesting enough, Sylvia, I was just reading the lyrics to the Internationale, the anthem of the International Workers of the World, on this May Day. This is one of the verses that caught my attention. "Behold them seated in their glory, the kings of mine and rail and soil. What have you read in all their story but how they plundered toil? Fruits of the workers' toil are buried in strongholds of the idle few. In working for their restitution, the men will only claim their due. If only that were happening, right?
Then right.
The reverse is happening under Trump. He's enabling the extraction industries to exploit not just the land,
That's right.
But also the workers.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I'm not sure if they're good billionaires or bad billionaires. I just want them to pay their fair share in taxes. You know, the tax burden 30 years ago, about a third of all federal taxes came via corporate taxation. Today it's less than it's less than 10%. The tax burden has been shifted onto the backs of basically typical workers as they try to cut any benefits for these typical workers, such as now they're trying to cut food stamps. Look, we have plenty of money in this country. We're one of the richest countries in the world. We should always keep that in mind, because the idea that we can't afford this, but we can afford, like you say, to have individuals now that are subsidizing space travel, well, that's fine. But first you have to help subsidize everything else in the country before you're allowed to do that. Your money should go through the public sector in the form of taxation, and then you can do with it whatever you would like.
Well, just to go back to the comedian that's gotten so much flack from the White House Correspondents' Dinner, Michelle Wolf, you know, the last line in her comedy riff that's upset so many Republicans in the White House and also the Washington Press Corps, her last line in parting was, "And the people in Flint are still drinking poisonous water." So
yes, I mean, and amazing that nobody's really talking about that. That in some respects was the most important line she said all night. In the United States of America, for this long, and it has been a long time, that it happened to begin with is unbelievable. That it's still going on is criminal. And again, this goes through investments in the public sector. This is going through, you know, the plutocracy, the haves and the have-nots. And it's just really shameful what is going on in Flint, Michigan.
Well, just in closing, do you see this as an opportunity for the Democrats in November, since these are red states? I mean, some of them have drunk in the Kool-Aid that Donald Trump has stolen the white working class, although this seems to fly in the face of that theory.
Well, I really don't know. All I can say is that these teachers, and I don't think we're going to stop here at Colorado. I think there's going to be more actions across more states. And, you know, the people who are running for office in them states and certainly federally are going to have to start listening to these teachers. And I think they're going to bring a lot of other workers along with them as we keep talking, like you and I are, about the issues here. What are we really dealing with? And putting this in the context of, you know, ever-growing inequality and ever, you know, growing tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. There's a price to be paid, and part of that price is in public education. Our children, the most important people that will be running this country in the future, they need those investments. And so it's been kind of amazing what is happening, and inspirational what's happening. Because in this country, the right of collective action, the right of collective bargaining, is one of the only things that is going to help to reverse or even mitigate the vast inequality and growing inequality that we have in this country. We need to have worker voice. We can't let the plutocrats run away with everything.
Well, Sylvia Allegretto, I thank you for joining us on this May Day.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Sylvia Allegretto, who is a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, teacher pay, public employee compensation, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining further the erosion of America's middle class, with 63% of Americans one paycheck away from the street and unable to deal with a $500 emergency.
Stand up, all victims of oppression, for the tyrants fear your might. Don't cling so hard to your possessions, for you have nothing if you have no right.
empire's fall. Freedom is me. They say we're back as capital. It fills us now. Come in, let us.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sarah Jaffe, who's a Nation Institute Fellow and an independent journalist covering labor, economic justice, social movements, politics, gender, and pop culture. She is the co-host with Michelle Chen of Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast and the author of Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Jaffe.
Hello.
And happy May Day to you.
And happy May Day to you.
And on this May Day, it's worth noting that nearly half of Americans have a tough time paying their bills. Over one-third have faced hardships such as running out of food, not being able to afford a place to live, or not having enough money to pay for medical treatment. And something like 63% of Americans are one paycheck away from the street, and they can't deal with a $500 emergency. So this is not the America that our billionaire president talks about.
Well, I heard he was going to make America great again.
I mean, it's people are struggling, and that's been true for a while, and it's even more true now than it was a couple of years ago.
And what can change this dynamic then? I mean, if this is a day to recognize that those who toil are not profiting, and those who are rewarded certainly may not deserve the extent of their rewards, particularly now that billionaires and millionaires have been given these massive tax cuts.
Yeah, the history of May Day goes back, you know, over 100 years and to Chicago in this country, to the struggle over the eight-hour day. And so when we think back to the beginning of the labor movement in this country, you know, we've seen it rise. We've seen it fall. Right now, we're at something like 10% union density altogether, something like 6% in the private sector. And we see the results of that over the last 40 years, right? We've seen increasing inequality. We've seen, as you were just saying, the fact that more and more people in this country have trouble coming up with $500 to make an emergency, can't pay the bills. And right now, the priorities of the government that we have was to give rich people, as you said, more tax cuts.
And at the political level, of course, more and more states are turning against labor and becoming so-called right-to-work states.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back to the last time the Democrats had the trifecta, which is what the Republicans have now, the control of the
right.
White House, the Senate, and the House, in 2008 when Obama came in, he wanted to put through legislation to protect labor against the encroachment of these right-to-work moves and basically immunize labor against the kind of assaults that they're under now, particularly at the Supreme Court level. But he couldn't get the support within his own party. And one of the people that frustrated him was the Democratic senator from Indiana, Evan Bayh, who ended up, guess what, when he retired, working for the Chamber of Commerce. So is that a problem that within the political left of this country, the party that represents the political left, you have a kind of Wall Street corporate wing?
Yeah, well, right. People would argue whether that party represents the political left or represents the sort of, you know, the center to the left, I guess. And right, you saw that exactly, that the Democrats, when they're in power, they can't agree on doing things that would baseline, I mean, among other things, help the party, although that's not the goal of labor legislation. It certainly is a side effect of it. And they couldn't do it because they are getting a lot of campaign donations from the same rich people who were putting a lot of money into those tax cuts. And so what we're seeing in state after state and
city after city even are attacks on labor. But we're also seeing, it's important to note, on May Day, we're seeing a really impressive fight back now. We have, as we're talking, teachers on strike in Arizona. I got a report that some 10,000 workers were on strike in Wisconsin protesting the 287G program, where law enforcement, local law enforcement collaborates with immigration enforcement. You have marches and protests around the country. And so labor isn't quite ready to count itself out just yet.
Well, added to that, teachers in, you mentioned Arizona, where they're striking today, and Colorado, where they've also been striking, West Virginia, mm-hmm. Oklahoma, and Kentucky.
Yeah.
All of these are red states, which indicates that maybe these states could be flipped. But it also indicates that these are right-to-work states. And even though it's illegal mm-hmm. for these teachers to go on strike, they're nevertheless doing it.
Yeah, well, and right-to-work, we should note, it doesn't make striking or unions illegal. It just makes them, it makes their funding harder. What right-to-work does is it requires, or it doesn't require workers who are covered by a union contract to pay a fee for their representation. So what the workers in places like West Virginia are facing is actually worse than right-to-work. They have no collective bargaining rights at all in the public sector in West Virginia, and yet they still managed to organize a statewide strike, 55 counties of teachers on strike for over a week, and won a 5% raise for every single public employee in the state of West Virginia. So, you know, it does remind us that even with right to work, there's plenty more that can be done.
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Jaffe, who's a Nation Institute fellow and an independent journalist covering labor, economic justice, social movements, politics, gender, and pop culture. She's the co-host with Michelle Chen of Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast and the author of Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. So at this point, of course, much of the debate within the Beltway is all of that indignation on the part of the Beltway journalists at a comedian who spoke a truth to power and made some uncomfortable remarks about the collusion, if you will, between those in power in the White House and those that cover them. But what was interesting about Michelle Wolff's comedy riff at the White House Correspondents' Dinner was her last line, which was, "And the people in Flint are still drinking poisonous water."
Yeah.
So give me a sense of, obviously we can't expect on this May Day to get a lot of coverage about workers' rights and economic justice, and that's why I'm talking to you. What do you think is the take-home here? What should people be doing to reverse this trend of essentially not just basically screwing the working class in this country, but also working towards the destruction of the middle class?
Yeah, I think the teachers have the right idea. You know, what we're seeing in those states, and as you mentioned, in red states, in places where there's not even collective bargaining rights for public employees, you're seeing people with not a lot left to lose. And so what happens when you have, you know, 700 teacher vacancies like they had in West Virginia is they basically say, well, we dare you to fire us all. You can't even fill the job vacancies that you have. So, you know, they can go on strike, and they say, what are you going to do about it? And that's, you know, that's how they were able to shut down the entire state for over a week, again, because they were willing to take that risk, because they didn't see a lot of downside at this point. They're working in public schools that have overcrowded classrooms, that have tattered textbooks, that buildings are falling apart, and that they're, you know, vacant spots that they can't fill because nobody wants to be a teacher, where you have to get a master's degree and you still make $40,000 a year.
Well, in your recent article, The Struggle to Stay Middle Class, Sarah Jaffe, you say the destruction of the American middle class didn't just happen. It was deliberately done. So just briefly explain what this deliberate strategy is and therefore how we can counter it.
Yeah, so in that piece, I'm talking in particular about the destruction of the public sector. And so this is a strategy that has been put forward by particularly the Republican Party, although Democrats have been more than happy to pitch in places like Chicago and New York, to cut funding for public sector jobs, cut wages, cut benefits, cut pensions, and also to just cut public sector jobs and replace them with private employees, whether we're talking about things like charter schools or other privatization schemes. And what that's done is it's driven down the wages, not just for public sector workers, but all workers. When the government ends up a lousy employer, that's one less thing that private sector employers have to compete with. And it sets a tone and says, this is what the government gets away with, so this is what you can get away with if you are, you know, Citibank or McDonald's or whatever, whoever the private employer is, right? So what happens then is you, especially for women and especially for people of color in this country, the public sector has always been the seat of middle-class jobs, public school teachers, the post office, things like that. So when you make those jobs into worse jobs, you're making them worse for a very specific set of people. And this kind of divide and conquer we saw in places like Wisconsin, where Scott Walker attacked public sector collective bargaining back in 2011. And it worked, unfortunately, in a lot of places, that kind of divide and conquer strategy. And then, you know, they passed the attack on collective bargaining for public sector workers. And then they came back 2 years later and made the state right to work. And that affected private sector workers. And it just shows you, once again, how, you know, you can't assume that if they're coming for somebody else, they're not going to come back for you later. The whole point of this is to make labor cheaper and easier to exploit.
Well, just in the last minute, given that these teachers are demonstrating and they're putting their bodies on the line, is that the answer? Should every working American, every middle-class American who's being shafted, should they all just suddenly take to the streets?
Well, the thing about that is you have to be a little strategic and you have to coordinate it. You can't just sort of walk out on the streets by yourself. The work that the teachers in these states have done to actually make sure that they were all on the same page, they were all going to go on strike on the same day, and that they weren't going to go back in when somebody made threats. You know, organizing stuff like that is hard. It's come together amazingly quickly because people have seen the success in West Virginia. So that teachers in Oklahoma saw that West Virginia did it and it worked. And so you've seen this ripple effect because, you know, nothing breeds success like success. But we should say that strikes are hard to pull off. That said, they are one of the most effective ways to make people take notice that you are not going to take it anymore.
Well, that's the way for us all to be counted. And there's a hell of a lot more of us than there are of the Koch brothers.
That is true. There are only two of them.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us on this May Day, Sarah Jaffe.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Jaffe, who is a Nation Institute fellow and an independent journalist covering labor, economic justice, social movements, politics, gender, and pop culture. She is the co-host with Michelle Chen of Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast and the author of Necessary Trouble, Americans in Revolt. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.